Slight programming note, we've had some change in our dynamics of our panel, so folks couldn't be with us today, but we're very lucky to have John Stevens from Dell with us instead of some of the folks who were scheduled to be here, and I think it's going to wind up being a little bit more balanced as we have some folks from the agency side as well as some folks from the client side. So just to give you an idea of why the slides look the way they do, this is kind of a composite of some RFP guidelines we've experienced in the past. We're trying to stick to them in the spirit of our talk. We're going to briefly introduce ourselves and start with Todd.
Hi, everybody. I am Todd Nienkirk. I'm a partner at Four Kitchens here in Austin, Texas. We are a web design and development studio that specializes in open source software and, in particular, Drupal.
I'm John Stevens. Thank you for making me the player to be named later. Glad to be here to work at Dell, just up the road. I work for a group within Dell called Global Site Design, or GSD. And we are Dell's in-house digital agency. We actually get to participate and enjoy the RFP process sort of from both sides of the equation. So thanks for having me.
And I'm Joe Rinaldi. I'm the business development director from HappyCog, and we design awesome websites. This panel is really about the RFP process and understanding a little bit more about it. So I think we want to get a sense of your perspective and your experience with RFPs as well.
Yes. So how many people here in the past 12 months have written an RFP, not replied to one, but have written one?
Oh, cool. Awesome.
All right. And how many people have responded to an RFP? That's kind of what we expected. Okay.
Awesome.
Excellent. Go.
So, you know, everyone, I think, has some RFP war stories. I'm reminded of one that we experienced relatively recently with an RFP that came out maybe about 2 months ago. So if any of this seems familiar and anyone was faced with this similar RFP, let me know. One of the questions that I asked in our Q&A for the RFP was how many firms were invited to respond to the RFP, and their answer was 364. I followed up with a return question, and they did not respond. This, to me, is not necessarily the way that you want to build an RFP and invite this many folks to the dinner. But I think it's symptomatic of what we're trying to address today. There are certainly some reasonable reasons why RFPs exist. You know, we're not blind to the fact that they serve a serious function. So I think Todd's going to walk us through a couple of those.
Right. So there's the good reason, and that's the reason that we all assume going into responding to an RFP, is that there's work to be done, and somebody wants to potentially hire you to do it. And all of that seems to make sense and is above board, and that's what we all assume, but there are a lot of other reasons that weren't really clear to me until I started doing this kind of business. And over the past 6 years or so, I've learned that usually that's actually not the reason. I'd say probably just about more than 50% of the time, it's because people feel like that's just how they've always done it. They have always written an RFP, and therefore they will continue to write RFPs, and they don't really know of anything else. It could be that somebody is brand new to this and somebody has told them, hey, we need to find a vendor to do something with a website or to help us build a house or to do something like that. And they just assume that, I guess I'm supposed to write an RFP, so they Google it and they get a template. And that template online is usually pretty horrific because it's going to have things like values, delete this if you're not going to use it, right? Or list all personnel and have the most complicated and detailed junk in the template that they download. So they just, you know, Google it, they download a template, and they think that's what all RFPs look like, and they ship it out. It could be that, and these get into the pretty cynical reasons here, but these do exist, unfortunately.
It's a very dark page, too.
It is. This is a dark page. So it could be that a client knows they're going to do work with a particular vendor. They have no intention of moving away from that particular vendor, but they want to try and keep costs down. And one of the ways that they do that is they put out that project to bid, get new prices, and leverage those prices against the vendor. So not only are the people who spent all this time responding to the proposal or responding to the RFP in the form of a proposal never going to get that job to begin with, but their low bids are then going to be used against another company to lower their bids. It could be free consulting. It could be that somebody says, oh, I have no idea how to do this. Let's issue an RFP and get some ideas, and then we'll have a blueprint, because a lot of RFPs, after all, say be specific, right? You do a lot of free consulting. You fill out reasons why you want to do certain things, what platform you're going to use, what technologies you're going to employ, how they're going to talk to each other, and you're doing this because you want to demonstrate that you know what you do, right? You know what you're doing. You're qualified for this job. And that company is going to take that proposal, and put it in-house because they now have a blueprint. There's also risk aversion. So in other words, if somebody at a company is told, we need to hire somebody for this job, we've got this big project, that person is might be responsible in terms of, well, in other words, their job might be on the line if this project doesn't go well. If the person they hire turns out to not be very good, they could be fired. And one way they can help distribute this responsibility is to require a very detailed proposal and a very lengthy proposal process to distribute that responsibility to the vendor and then be able to say, well, you know, everything checked out. The proposal looked really good. It was really detailed. They said it would happen on this date. They said they were going to use these technologies and use it as a way to blame the vendor, in other words. And then the last reason, and I don't know how often this really happens, I don't think I've been part of this process, but I think, Joe, you mentioned you found out you had been part of this. It's to qualify new vendors. So in other words, this isn't really like a bad reason, but it's a little misleading. Some companies just want to develop a larger network of vendors to work with, and they want to have some reason to interview them and get to know what they do and what they're good at. But they wrap it inside this framework of, we have a project to potentially sell to you. But in fact, what they're doing is just getting to meet new people and networking. And they should really frame it that way as opposed to putting out an RFP and getting people's hopes up about new business.
I think it's a valuable exercise. I think it just can be, you know, presented the right way. So I think if it's a vendor that's invited to come in to do a capabilities presentation, knowing what the landscape is, that makes sense. It makes more sense when you're paid to do that kind of, you know, presentation. It mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense if they come to your location on like a road trip or a road tour, which I've seen as well, rather than inviting vendors to come in to kind of just do a capabilities presentation for a potential project. But I think we see that both kind of exist.
Is there a non-dark slide?
Very briefly in the beginning.
That was one good point that we raised at the beginning.
So I've been through, you know, countless, what do you want to call them, exercises where all of the above have happened. You know, certainly when I was on the agency side, and the larger the agency you're at, you know, the larger sort of the, you know, the win could be. Yeah, there's the reasons behind it, you know, no you're never 100% clear if you know if there's a backstory to it, but I will say, still sort of fresh from taking kind of this leap to the sort of the other side, on the client side, it is the one benefit is being able to, as long as you've sort of vetted your list and that you've kind of you're excited to kind of talk to these new potential partners. I think there is some value in seeing how they think. And seeing how they operate, can they make a deadline? You know, can they articulate themselves in something that's other than just a sort of garden variety capabilities presentation? Can they, you know, what's the engagement like? So there is, and granted, on top of all those other reasons, whether it's trying to, you know, drill down an existing vendor or just kind of sending people out on a fishing expedition. I mean, Lord knows it happens. It happens every day. If you're really serious about it, it does serve, I think, a meaningful purpose to see who sends their you know, RFP in by the deadline and who sends theirs in at, you know, 1:22 a.m. the night of. It gives you a little bit of a sense. You're not going to judge them entirely on it, but I think it's a worthwhile exercise just to kind of make sure that who you're engaging is for real. You know, do they have the sort of operational capacity to actually even get this initial request done? So
I think one thing that I've experienced over the past maybe 6 months really acutely is that while that is kind of a great exercise and there is certainly a dialogue to be had, I think that there's also, when you start to establish those parameters, there is a way or there is an opportunity for an organization to build a practice or to build an approach that kind of games the system. So I think that there certainly are some you know, agencies that really build like an internal specialization around fielding RFPs, responding to RFPs, pitching an RFP.
And
it's not always, you know, a bad thing. Sometimes it is really, you know, a really articulate way to start a project. But sometimes it really is kind of a shell game where it's, you know, one approach that kind of speaks to an RFP, but there's another approach that speaks to the work itself. I think what's critical is, as someone on the agency side, is understanding if responding to an RFP is always or sometimes or never in your best interest, because it just depends on your own internal capability to have that kind of conversation and to dedicate resources towards that.
Or if it's, you know, the initial RFP is issued on February 1st with a decision by April 1st, but fast forward to July 20th and it's still sort of happening. So it's one of those Yeah, it's. I'm sure, judging by the hands that were raised, I think everyone's sort of been in those situations once or 20 times.
All right. So we'd like to do a bit of a case study here with 4Kitchen. So we're going to peel back the onion skin and take a look at what's going on within our company. So about 6 months ago, we started working with Happy Cog on a proposal, on a particularly onerous proposal.
It's right up there. And
this was the first time I had ever heard somebody say that they were RFP averse. It had never really occurred to me that maybe RFPs are terrible and that maybe there's another way to do all of this stuff. So we took a look at our business and we tried to figure out how much effort we're actually putting into this RFP process and whether or not it's paying off. And this is what we found. We discovered that we were spending between 30 and 40 hours per RFP response. So an entire work week was going into the research and the Q&A and the communication and all of that. The opportunity cost, therefore, was between $5,000 and $7,000 per response. Because we have developers and designers write the proposals. We don't have a sales team. We don't have a group of people that just crank out boilerplate, make a bunch of promises, and then come back to the developers and say, hey, guess what we sold today? And you're going to have to deliver this. The people who are actually going to work on the project write the proposal. So we're actually taking work away from them that they could be billing. So we're losing between $5,000 and $7,000 per proposal that we write. Only 16% of our total work resulted from RFPs. So 16% of our income is directly attributable to RFPs. And we won only 22% of all of the RFP-driven proposals that we submitted. So we're not getting a lot of them, and we're not getting a lot of money as a result of them. But on the flip side, 84% of the work resulted from just personal connections and word of mouth. So 84% of the work were people who walked in the door deciding that they had already heard of us, or they already wanted to work with us, or they just wanted to sit down and have a conversation and not do the whole RFP proposal thing. And additionally, and we tried doing this right around the time we started working with Happy Cog, we discovered that it really only cost about $2,000 to $3,000 to send three people on site to talk to a potential client for a day or two. That's about half the opportunity cost of actually sitting down and writing the proposal. So we would have actually, counterintuitively, saved money sending people across the country to go talk to a potential client face-to-face, and because so much of our work results from personal connections and knowing us and talking with us in person, we would be even more likely to get the work if we were sending people out there. So we concluded that RFPs have driven a small but not insignificant amount of business. 14, 16% is still a significant amount. But it costs way more. It costs way less for us to send people out in person. Somebody, when we had this meeting, if you could flip to the next slide for me, somebody suggested, hey, maybe we're just really bad at writing proposals. And, you know, that's possible, but I really don't think so. I think maybe I'm just sort of, you know, biased here, and I could be, but I've looked at other people's proposals, and they kind of feel about the same. Maybe a little bit better, I don't know. But it is worth saying that it's possible that we're just really, really bad at writing proposals, and our numbers are not representative. But I would like to hand it over to Joe, who's going to do the same thing for Happy
Well,
Cog.
You know, it was funny, because as we started this process, and kind of unrelated, we started to do our own internal kind of investigation of how we're assigning hours and effort towards RFPs as well. So we started to look at really scrutinizing our sales process to understand where is our time best spent. You know, this is kind of a money ball approach. It's an idea behind buying wins, understanding where you're really going to get the most value out of your team's effort, because similar to 4Kitchens, you know, we don't pitch in a vacuum. This is not me going by myself in a sales role to kind of go and win business. This is our directors peeling off of client work to apply themselves to an estimate or apply themselves to a proposal. So we looked at our total leads from the past year. We looked at then more closely the quality wins and losses. So, you know, certainly we get some leads that come out of, you know, the ether, and they're not really something that we would normally pursue. So we looked closely at the leads that we thought were valuable and viable. We then looked at, among that group, the subset that really came into an RFP, and looked at the percentage of wins and losses there. Then we calculated the opportunity cost. So right off the bat, we calculated the travel expenses. That's, you know, train, or that's airfare, that's an overnight stay, all those kinds of, you know, easy to diagnose cost. But then we also looked at to Todd's point, again, the opportunity cost, looking at the time spent traveling, the time spent developing the proposal, the time spent actually in a pitch meeting or unexpected secondary pitch meetings or unexpected third pitch meetings, and looking at really, you know, this is time not spent on client work. There is an opportunity cost associated with this. So we looked at the revenue that we generated from some RFPs that we won, and we looked at the revenue lost in RFPs that we lost. Certainly, we made more money on the ones we won because we did win a couple, and that's something that I wanted to make sure, you know, we were very clear about. We didn't come to the determination that we aren't going to respond to any RFPs. I mean, if we had that policy, we wouldn't have worked with Harvard last year. We wouldn't have worked with Club Nintendo. These are two engagements that both came in through RFPs. But I also think when we looked at really closely, there were some RFPs that we responded to that, in hindsight, we kind of knew at the time that this was kind of a, we're taking a shot at this. I think historically, it's worth noting that our business has been built very, very strongly on referrals, very much based on, you know, reputation and people that know other people that work with us. RFPs kind of crept into our portfolio more and more, and a sizable chunk came in after we did our work with Zappos. We all of a sudden found ourselves seeing more RFPs because we were on a different kind of radar, and we're excited about the kind of products we could consider. But there's a tremendous amount of danger in getting wrapped up in what appears to be a sexy project when there's so many warts between you and the finalization of the. You find yourself kind of apologizing away some of the ugly things you'll be subject to in the course of even the vendor evaluation, if not the work itself, for the promise that you'll get to work with, you know, brand X or brand Y. So I want to make sure that, you know, we're clear that we have certainly done some work in that space, but we're also scrutinizing it really closely. The other thing that's worth noting, too, though, I mentioned Harvard and I mentioned Club Nintendo. While we did those products and we love those products, we've also since then rejected or passed on other RFPs that have come from Harvard and that have come from Nintendo because they came from a different department. The RFP we got from Harvard for Harvard.ed was a one-page document. It was requirements. It was very articulate, very buttoned down. But then we've got another RFP from another department at Harvard that was exactly this. You know, you have to respond in PowerPoint, 12-point font, this number of pages, this kind of requirement. So even within one organization, someone found a way to kind of circumvent this hardwired process. Other folks weren't able to diagnose that. So it leads to, I think, a hopeful place where when you have kind of a roadmap or a vision for how an RFP can be better, you can get there. Obviously, somebody at Harvard is doing it the right way, while other folks are kind of mired down in a way that's been done before. And similar, same thing in Nintendo. So I think there's certainly a light at the end of the tunnel. And one of the things we want to talk about today was some of what I experienced working with John in a RFP for Dell. I think it was a good example of an RFP done the right way.
Okay. The other thing that's interesting to think about when you talk about the opportunity costs and the other sort of disadvantage, I think that, well, it depends on how you look at it. Disadvantage or sort of the difference between smaller independent agencies or service provider, you know, companies who may or may not, you know, be part of a holding company, may not have this sort of vast, you know, bucket of resources that you'd get with a, you know, a larger group that could maybe, you know, tap into another office, or they could very well have a a whole team of sort of new business people who, you know, that's their life. You know, it's not a matter of kind of, you know, pulling people off projects. There could be someone or a group that's sort of in between clients or, you know, whatever. So I think the other crucial thing, and at least with HappyCog, you know, the different events you have and the sort of the thought leadership part of the equation, I think is a completely sort of different way to look at things rather than sort of, you know, waiting for the calls and certainly using those connections. But how can you position yourself to get on those different radars apart from the work, but also mm-hmm. sort of saying letting that work sort of serve as sort of a North Star for where the business and where the industry is going. So I think that's one way to overcome maybe some hurdles you might have if you're going up against sort of larger established companies that sort of have the big portfolio and you know sort of the multiple offices and mm-hmm. things like that. So when we issued RFP last summer, doesn't feel that long ago, but it was. You know, one of the benefits of this group that I'm in, Global Site Design, is that we're pretty autonomous within Dell. So I'm sure, as you all know, Dell is just a, you know, machine, and it's storied legacy of agency partners and you know, digital and otherwise that Dell's worked with over the last few years. And there is actually an agency management office within the organization. That's not procurement. This is an office that only deals with sort of the relationships, the negotiations, the scopes of work with sort of, you know, these larger agency partners that serve the different business units of the company. There's not just one agency. There's different agencies, traditional, digital, PR, et cetera, who service the different parts of the land of Dell. So it's a necessary sort of part of the equation. It's just such a huge company. There's so much cash. There's so many sort of business needs that need to be, you know, codified and organized into some kind of RFP. It's a great office because we didn't really have a deep office that or a, sort of a deep bench or a large operation that could handle that before. And it's helped smooth a lot of areas that I could see because I was with one of Dell's agencies before I came over. But with GSD, we actually had the benefit through our own autonomy to sort of run this on our own. And we are within Dell, but there's a large portion of us come from the agency side. A large portion of us have been at Dell for a long time. And so there's a good sort of mix of knowledge and experiences from before. And one thing that we wanted to do was make sure that we didn't get, we wanted to make sure that agency management, procurement, the business stakeholders were all sort of covered off on, but we wanted to make sure this was a RFP that we controlled, that we, based on our experiences and based on kind of what we knew about Dell, how could we construct this so that we're not creating hours of busy work? How can we do it so that we're being very transparent about what our intentions are, what the objectives are, why we're talking about a particular project? And I think the key was, additionally, not knowing what people's sort of preconceived notions might be about Dell. It's this massive company that you read about all the time that, has sort of this long list of agencies that they've worked with and don't work with anymore. And so you wanted to, I think our key was trying to put some human face on the process, not just sort of like, you know, shove it into an agency management and procurement process, which I think after a while just sort of erodes people's enthusiasm and people's sort of interest in the project. I think we wanted to make sure that we could sort of work directly with these folks, not just issue a 10-page RFP and then, you know, get it back in 4 weeks. So apart from managing and kind of creating a relationship with the prospective agencies, we also need to make sure that we apply the same touch to the many stakeholders that we, that were kind of behind this particular project. So I think that the key, at least one of the guiding principles for us, was to make sure that this was transparent. It made sense in terms of what we were asking for. We're very, very sensitive. As sort of an agency within Dell, we're very sensitive to the preciousness of hours and people's time. And so we tried to be really clear about it. And are there slides that...
Oh, we're right here.
Well, there you go.
Okay, great.
Then I will actually talk to the slides instead of just stammer on. So there was the project requirements, and also people who hadn't necessarily worked with Dell before, maybe people had sort of heard, you know, had experiences or whatnot. We wanted to make sure that there was a proper cultural snapshot, not just of Dell, but of GSD. We sort of pride ourselves on being, like I said, autonomous. We've got a sort of terrific team of UX folks and designers, people with great talent, and we also know a lot about Dell, so we wanted to make sure that the people who we were reaching out to knew that they had an advocate and someone who kind of understood the sort of the highways and byways of the process there. The other key was to make sure that while we were controlling it, that the people, when I say stakeholders, I mean people who are helping pay for it and who are actually kind of who sort of donated to the hat that we passed around the organization to actually fund the project that we were putting out for bid. Make sure they're very clear on what's happening. Make sure they understand they have a voice. Make sure kind of that they feel a part of it. We're aware of their requirements. So it's nothing that's sort of rocket science, but within sort of these large organizations, there's some politics. People have a point of view about, you know, the way certain things should be. And so there's as much sort of back, sort of legwork that we were doing to kind of keep it on track. The other thing that we had was this office hours thing. So rather than just sending the proposal out and then getting an email in 4 weeks, we also wanted to make sure that during the what we're just calling sort of the discovery process, we wanted to make sure that the initial period was as much about the agencies interviewing us as it was about us vetting them. And so we had office hours and I think a pretty decent engagement with folks who had questions about just what this was, being very, I think, very open and hopefully helpful in providing whatever background people were needing, not just sort of making people look in this sort of narrow place of an RFP. We wanted to make sure people were educated on what this thing was about, because it's a pretty strategic project for us. When it comes to procurement, you have to have a partnership with them. I literally just started at Dell, I don't know, a couple months before this thing was even issued, and I didn't know, you know, Scott from Joe from Nathan in procurement, so we had to sort of build that bridge a little bit, especially since we weren't working with the agency management office. It's, you know, it's a necessary part of the equation, but it helps make sure that we've kind of got those, you know, the I's dotted, T's crossed, and it's more than just making sure everyone signs an NDA. Big organization like Dell, you need to make sure procurement's kind of with you, because there are just a lot of sort of corporate governance and policy boxes to check. So that was actually pretty helpful to us, so we weren't too far out there. Room to improve. We hadn't really had the post-mortem on that. We were actually pretty pleased. We were pleased with, we felt like the process really kind of let us key on the folks who we felt were kind of real prospects. And also, I feel like after the process, we were still in touch with folks who may, you know, who didn't get the bid too. I felt like there weren't hard feelings necessarily. There were people who felt like they were, you know, appreciative of being part of the process.
Did you follow up with those vendors and give them some feedback on why they didn't get the bid?
Yes, and no. Yeah, we made sure the August was kind of a squirrely month for that, but we opened that up and we made sure. Yeah, I mean, the transparency didn't end with the decision. We felt like, hey, if you want to know kind of where you can, you know, not where you fell down, but kind of where you can kind of, you know, improve things, or it's obviously nothing personal, but it's kind of, here's some rationale behind it. I know we had a conversation about that in September, I think. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't, that the transparency and that the professionalism in terms of the dialogue was maintained, because I think some of these, you know, some large companies, it's pretty, whether it's a large company or sort of, you know, dealing with these like federal government, you know, 120 page RFPs, you know, it's somewhat impersonal, and not to get too, you know, gooey about it, but we wanted to make sure that it was something that, you know, that there was some dialogue to it that wasn't, you know, just a kind of cold and hard.
So I have a question for the audience, actually. How many people here have responded to an RFP and actually heard why you did not get the job? How many people have never heard why they didn't get the job? Okay, that's about even. All right.
Two. Okay.
Hello.
The other thing about the summer, it was just sort of a hiccup for the process. I mean, the other thing too is issuing it in June, you start losing people on the client side, on the agency side, in the sort of July period. So not that you would never issue an RFP in July, you just have to do what the business dictates. But that was one little kink. I don't think it really impacted us too badly. And then kind of keeping that thread of the sort of the transparency and, you know, again, the engagement that happens in the RFP, it is up to the client, in my opinion, more so than the agency, to sort of pay that off once the engagement starts. If it becomes, it's this very sort of rosy courtship, and then the minute that you get the business, it just becomes hell. Then you haven't done your job in this sort of the engagement process. So that was something that we were trying to be, I think, somewhat protective, if you want to call it that, of the folks that we were talking to make sure that they could use us as sort of their navigators in the process.
I think, you know, I think there's a natural instinct to want to involve more vendors and have more options. I get that. I think that one way that you could, as someone on the client side, ensure that you don't get too ambitious in the number of vendors that you invite is if you make the commitment that Dell made to follow up with everyone in depth how the process went, where things kind of landed. If you are committed to that level of transparency and that kind of communication with all the vendors you invite, you'll invite a shorter list. You'll invite a more you know, selected kind of list that you've kind of vetted and evaluated more closely. If you know that you're going to be on the hook for that kind of ongoing conversation once it's over, you don't want to have 45 conversations. You don't want to have 364 conversations. You know, if you have a small set, then you can kind of honor that commitment and maintain that. I think, you know, if there's any one thing that frustrates me in my role in an RFP is when you do go through that process and you invest that kind of time and effort into any response, if it's an RFP or not even an RFP, and this isn't, you know, unique to RFPs, but if you don't win the gig and then don't get any kind of clarification on, you know, how the decision was made or where, you know, the capability was identified that maybe you didn't have, I think that's not infrequent, that it's just kind of you get an email that you didn't get it and that's kind of expected to be the end. I am a total pain in the ass about that and hammer them for explanations for, you know, why it didn't happen or, you know, can you help tell us where, you know, maybe someone else was a better fit.
Well, especially, you know, when some of these things, you know, the sort of the days are dying out where actually, you know, vendors actually get some money to go through the process to actually cover the cost of it. You know, God forbid, you know, you, so especially if it's some, one of those things where there's not necessarily an investment that the client has made, I think at the very least you can do is be honest with them and try and provide some perspective and some pointers on kind of where, you know, what was missing or where we thought was great and where we thought maybe you needed some, you know, is an opportunity. So,
So out of all this, I think we have a desire to have some kind of hopeful next steps. I think that is really our goal. I don't think anybody wants to sit here and just compare, you know, war wounds of sales. I think we want to make sure that there's some guidelines or some ideas that anyone can kind of apply to their process. So we have some bullets that we'd like to kind of talk about with relation to how clients create RFPs. We'd also have some bullets about how some folks can apply themselves to responding to RFPs. So Todd's going to talk us through some of the ideas on the client side.
Sure. So clients. When you are writing an RFP for a creative project, expect a creative response and allow for a creative response. So if you are issuing an RFP with guidelines such as this must be given to us in Word 2000 format in 12-point Times New Roman with 1-inch margins, no longer than 5 pages, no longer than 5,000 words or whatever it is, you are limiting the ability of the organization to show you that they are creative, and now you're only comparing essays. So are you actually looking for somebody to write essays for you for a project? No, right? You're looking for creative work, right? Allow them to be creative. Allow them to do whatever they can possibly do to demonstrate to you that they are the right creative fit. Now, if you're looking for a technical project, don't expect the technical project to be creative, and don't let the creative stuff wow you away from the technical stuff. Because often there are vendors out there that have really awesome sales processes, that have amazing teams, that have really great boilerplate and really awesome templates that they use with great headshots of their team and all of this stuff. It's going to obscure the fact that they might actually not know what they're doing technically. And also, they might be subcontracting all this stuff out because there's some larger agency that just hoovers in all of these contracts and then subs everything out to smaller companies like ours, right? So frame your RFP in terms of what kind of project you're trying to accomplish and allow those people to do what it is they're good at. Allow them to be technical in a technical proposal. Allow them to be creative in a creative proposal. So in other words, I understand that the reason why a lot of people, and this is really big in the grant community, as an aside, I worked as a student, I worked at a grant office at UT Austin. Anybody here from UT Austin work there? Okay, so I used to do some grant proposal stuff. And right before we mailed it out, and of course it had to be mailed via airmail DHS, you know, 4 p.m. Friday, whatever. I would sit there with these 200-page stacks and a ruler, and I would randomly pick pages and count the number of characters within an inch to make sure that it didn't exceed their regulations. People win and lose grants for stuff like that, which is ridiculous. So in our world, it's not quite as onerous, right? But people are doing this to try and level the playing field. They're trying to say, I want everybody here to have a fair shake, so everything should be 12-point font, Everybody should have a 1-inch margin. But in fact, if this is a battle of creativity, shouldn't you be allowing creativity? Shouldn't you be breaking all of those boundaries? Because again, you're not trying to hire people to write essays for you.
And also, to be clear, we're also not suggesting that they would do creative work for free. It's just the creative application to answering that challenge. You know, everything's it's a problem to be solved. So responding to an RFP is another opportunity to design or to get creative within constraints. So we're not saying that you would, you know, it's a slippery slope to get into more and more creative work. And we're not advocating that you would ask someone to do a creative exercise or get into some free design work by any means.
Right. Another thing that clients can do, the people who are issuing RFPs, is to require that they speak to the people who are actually going to work on the project. So instead of just dealing with a sales team or, you know, a partner at a firm or something like that, ask that you actually want to indicate that you really want to speak to a developer there, a designer there, because those are the people you're actually going to be working with, right? So make sure you talk to them. The salespeople are going away as soon as you give them the job. You're never going to talk to them ever again.
Get them the heck out of there.
Right? So talk to the people you're actually going to work with because, you know, again, like rosy courtship, right? If it goes south, it might be because you didn't, you hadn't actually met the people you're really going to work with. So kind of avoid that sales layer. Sales should facilitate this process. It shouldn't own the process, in other words. So sometimes vendors do that. Don't allow the vendors to do that. Beware of low bids. They are too good to be true. I don't know what it is they're doing. They are wrong. They either don't know what they're doing or they completely misunderstand the scope of a project. It's maybe best, I don't know, I'm going to throw this out there. I'm making this up off the top of my head. Maybe you should do like a low high and get your stack of proposals, right? And just take the most expensive one and take the cheapest one and just throw them away. Because chances are, let's not throw them away. Let's talk to them. Let's contact them and make sure that they understand the scope of the project, because a low bid usually means they have entirely missed the mark. Mm-hmm. And a high bid means, well, who knows what that means. Pre-select. So Dell earlier limited the number of vendors to a relatively small number. If you can somehow pre-select and not send proposals to 300, or not send RFPs to 364 companies and get 364 responses, you're just going to get a bunch of garbage anyway. And who here wants to read more than 5 50-page proposals, right? I mean, you kind of, like, you glaze over after the first one because they're really big and really detailed because you asked us to be detailed, right? So pre-select, like, do some kind of pre-qualification. Call people up. Ask them the really basic questions. Make sure that, you know, if your organization requires you to only hire people within the continental United States, for example, make sure that the people you're contacting can actually work within those guidelines. If you have insurance requirements, you may want to do some pre-screening around those. Just try and really focus your base.
I mean, to me, that should be a fun exercise to be able to kind of cherry pick these agencies that you want to work with. That should be kind of a really awesome job to have that week where you get to look at these, you know, particular vendors and decide which ones you want to reach out to. Just as an aside, Todd and I were meeting last night. We were talking about our panel, and we received an email at HappyCog asking if a client, you know, could kind of meet with us while we're in South By, that typical kind of email. But the person who had sent it had not corrected the copy and paste, and it was addressed to a different agency but sent to us. So obviously they were doing a bit of a cattle call and just kind of insert name here in a Mad Libs kind of approach. So, you know, it's not necessarily the way that you want to start a conversation with a potential partner.
And that's a good way to phrase it, by the way.
Right. I think that's
what we want to focus
partner.
On. Yeah.
Right. So from that other side of the equation, from the vendor, from the agency side, what can you do to kind of insulate yourself from an RFP, or at least be, you know, smart about applying or responding to an RFP? I think that it's totally fair to ask a client how many people have been invited to respond to the RFP. I think that that's a valid question. You understand kind of the constraints or the landscape of the process. You know what the timelines are, you know what the requirements are, you have a lot of visibility into the framework of the evaluation process. It's not unheard of to ask, you know, how many vendors have you invited to participate. I think that I think it's important also to start a dialogue. I think that the way that a lot of people look at an RFP is that it's kind of slammed down on your desk and it's, you know, respond. And it's on you to kind of just answer that charge. I think that, you know, you should start a dialogue. You should ask questions. You should start to be frank with a potential partner down the road and ask, you know, is it worth my time? I think, you know, there are vendors who, when I've asked this question, have said, well, actually, you know, we have a partner that we want to work with again, and we just need to kind of involve some other people that might be a fit for a future project. And I've offered at that point, you know, well, maybe what we can do is we can send you some information about our capabilities. We'd love to work with you on another project down the road, but you know, if you really have your heart set on one, maybe we can send you a different kind of document that's not quite as, you know, as large an investment in our time to respond. And if there's really not an opportunity to have that kind of conversation, if you find that you're up against a brick wall, I think a great question to ask is, how did you find out about us? Or how did you, you know, decide to invite us to the RFP? You can read volumes into their response. If it's, you know, we Googled e-commerce. Or, you know, there's, if they really have an explanation for why they reached out to you, if they understand you and your capabilities in a unique way, then that might be a reason to pursue it, that they actually did their homework and actually serious about working with you. But if there's no, you know, real concrete answer as to why they invited you to it, you may be column fodder and you may want to run from this RFP. I think another criteria that you could invest into or you could involve in an RFP would be requiring a face-to-face meeting. I've found, you know, on the same kind of scrutiny of sales over the past year, that we've been significantly more successful in engagements where we get into a room live and in person with the client and have a conversation. Those are typically pitches we win. We don't have that opportunity in every case, but I think we would benefit from having a firmer stance moving forward about even considering a bid where you don't get to meet face-to-face, and more specifically, the project team you meet face-to-face. One of the things that I thought was great about, you know, when we were talking with Dell was just the sheer volume of people that were there from the Dell side who were actually involved in the project.
We love meetings.
Yeah, and yeah. It wasn't a bunch of, you know, people that had nothing better to do who sat in on a meeting, you know, which you also see, and that's also something to be aware of, that, you know, these are folks you're never going to see again.
Well, that's part of the thing, too, is we didn't want to scare anybody off, but it's one of those things like, well, just so you know, yes, we're autonomous, but this is a good snapshot of the type of meeting that you may be in when you're presenting stuff. And it's just sort of, you know, not a centralized decision-making organization. There's just a lot of folks. So I think that's part of the engagement, yeah.
I think it's part of that evaluation of the client as well. I mean, you're in that room with these people, and, you know, we've talked about being in meetings where the client group started to disagree among themselves. They started to have a differing opinion even in that evaluation. Not in the Dell case.
No, never.
But we've been in meetings like that where there's been some actual, you know, disagreement among the folks from the client side. Well, then you know pretty clearly that they might not be ready for this project. They may not actually be, you know, as kind of thought through as you'd hope.
Just thinking about it. so there's a great case study of ours. We did work with this well-known university in the Northeast, and it was great, and we really loved working with them, and we wanted to continue, so we got another RFP from them, and we did this. We required a phone call because they weren't really being responsive. We didn't really have a lot of information, and when we got on the phone with them, it was clear that this was the first time these two people, the person who had written the RFP and the person who actually needed the work done, had ever really talked about this, because they introduced themselves to each other on the phone call. Oh, nice to finally meet you. Okay, so what is this about? Oh, we've got this potential vendor on the line. It's this project. And then we started asking our questions. And then the person who wrote the RFP says, I think it clearly states that whatever the other person says, that's actually not what we want. We need something very, very different. And then they just started to talk.
This is in the RFP, like, intro call?
This was a call that we had to kind of fight for. We had to say, like, hey, we really want a chance to talk to you. We have some questions, but we'd rather do it over the phone and not just send an email. And they just started talking. They just went off. And we realized at this point, this is not a good project for us. Because if they're disagreeing at this point, they have prematurely issued an RFP. Scope is not well defined. How can they possibly judge our scope and our budget if they haven't defined it on their end, right? Yeah.
And I think, you know, at that point, you need to make some critical decisions about whether or not you're going to pursue a project. And I know I've had these conversations with, you know, folks that I know who work at large agencies and folks that work at smaller agencies like ours. And I understand that there's, you know, a perception that, you know, we can't afford to say no to certain projects. You know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We need to be able to kind of take a chance on this. I agree with that. I think that there are occasions where you really have to kind of take a risk and extend yourself and go after something. But I also just want to mention that, you know, the loss in productivity, the operational cost, is sometimes you probably are more at risk investing and poorly investing your time that way than the off chance that you might land some, you know, great project through some insane, you know, kind of evaluation process. The one thing I want to mention too is I didn't realize I could do this, and when I started asking to do this, it was plainly apparent that it was always available, is to offer opportunities to change the process. You know, in talking to folks that have issued RFPs in the past year, you know, they may work on issuing five RFPs a year. They may work on issuing one RFP every 5 years. I mean, they're working with a limited number of RFPs for a limited amount of work that's coming through their department or their team. People on the agency side see, you know, an order of magnitude more RFPs. You're exposed to a variety of options, things that these folks may not even be aware of. You have some institutional knowledge you can apply to this. So I'm more and more encouraged by clients and the reaction when I ask them, you know, can we add, you know, a call, to Todd's point? Can we, you know, require face-to-face meetings for vendors? You know, going to a client and saying, you know, your RFP requires spec work. We're not going to provide that. We know that other vendors may provide that. That kind of creates a level playing field. Would you consider taking spec work out of the RFP entirely? And having clients say, yes, you know, we will take that out. You're right. You know, we didn't understand kind of what we were asking. So I think there's the worst thing that can happen is that they'll say no. And at that point, you can move forward with the project or not move forward with the project.
And if they say no rudely.
Right. Exactly. And that's a good point. And I think, you know, in not to sound too callous, but in a lot of RFPs, more often than not, you're dealing with someone who is tangential to the actual work itself. It is someone from procurement. It is someone that kind of is invested in this part of the process, but not in the project itself. If you ask to move something around and they say no, and this creates some tension in the project, you're probably not going to talk to this person again outside of the RFP. So if you're ruffling their feathers, it's okay to ruffle their feathers. They're probably not the project owner. So don't feel like you're, you know, ruining a possible partnership or collaboration by being a squeaky wheel. Be the squeaky wheel. I mean, the worst thing that they can say is no. And I think it's always worth exploring. I didn't realize how often you could actually reinvent an RFP on the fly by asking to change one or two things.
There's one point I'd like to add to the vendor slide. So earlier we said that it's okay to ask how many other vendors are being brought into this bid. I think it's also okay to ask, what is your budget?
Yeah.
We should always ask, what is the budget? And if they're cagey about that, and they think that, well, I don't want to give you this number, because if I give you this number, then you're just going to spit that number back at me. That's not true. So clients, that's not true. That's not what we're going to do with that number. We're going to take a quick glance at that number and realize that you are either crazy or you're not. And we will tell you, we will gladly say, oh, you want a Facebook clone for $20,000. You do realize that Facebook, right, you know, the story of Facebook 101, it's not going to happen for you. So you will actually get good feedback from telling somebody what the budget is, because you're going to have to then go back. I mean, I realize that a lot of clients are in the position where, you know, their boss's boss has said, we need to do this project and this is the budget. You need to have the ammunition to go back up the chain and say, it's not doable for this budget. I'm sorry, like, we've heard this from multiple potential vendors. It's just not doable. Yeah. We're going to need to cut back on scope or expand our budget.
Yeah.
So in some cases, I realize that, you know, maybe you're not allowed to mention a number because of certain bureaucratic or organizational requirements. But if there's some way that we can talk around that and just talk ballparks and say, you know, after reading this proposal, it seems like it's $100,000. Is that okay? Is that doable? Is that within your range? Then please be honest with us, because we're going to then spend 30 to 40 hours looking at this proposal and writing those numbers down in detail and how we arrived at those numbers, only to have it immediately thrown away.
And
the ranges are good. I mean, I think that it depends on the client. I think that there's probably some, depending on the size of the company and kind of what their background is, there's probably some institutional, at times, mistrust of agencies, because you will give them a budget of $1 million and the scope will come back at $999,050, you know. And, you know, you just don't know how lucky you are to get that deal. You know, it's just incredible how that worked out. So I think there's always an aversion to that. I think smaller projects, obviously the big ones with big brands, when there's, you know, media and sort of global considerations involved, you know, that's, those are just conversations that, that's why they bring in, you know, a third party to help kind of manage those as well. Agency recruitment firms, things like that, they can kind of deal with those, you know, less than awesome conversations when you're just starting to get to know each other. So on the smaller project stuff, yeah, I think range and, you know, depending if it's, if you're dealing with startups or smaller firms, they need to know going in if, you know, should we put 30, 40, 80, 120 hours into this and it ends up being a $30,000 project? I mean, then it just begins. So I think it's somewhat case by case, but especially when you're dealing with smaller projects and maybe more independent firms who, you know, where every dollar counts, you've got to be mindful of that, respectful of that.
There is sort of a strange, like, Newtonian versus quantum physics of large shops and large projects versus small shops and smaller projects. Yeah.
Yes.
So when you're dealing with contracts in the magnitude of, you know, $1 million, $10 million, something like that, different rules apply.
Yeah,
I think it's fair to say. Yeah. But at
I was a history major, so I didn't really take any quantum physics, but I understand. I understand what you're saying. Yes.
I think too, the other question or the answer you should be looking for as an agency when you ask the budget question, when you ask what is your budget, what I'm trying to diagnose as well is, has a budget been assigned to this yet? There are cases where there is no budget assigned to it, that they're then going to take your proposal and go back and fight for the budget that the vendors identify. That's an unfunded project. That's a project that you then are helping to shepherd through their internal organization, and that may not be the best investment of your time, too. You know, if they can go back and say, you know, this year we have X number of dollars allocated towards this initiative, it's carved out of our budget, that's great. If they come back to you and say, well, we're really looking for, you know, the vendors to help us understand and identify the price, then we'll go back and we'll get the budget that we need, you're now another step away from this project getting started. There is an internal, you know, organizational step that you have no control over that you're subject to, and your work's going to have to kind of be funneled through. So that's something to be aware of. We only have about 7 minutes left. So right. I know that we wanted to talk a little bit about our vision for what to do here, and I'll be very brief with my piece. My suggestion or my hope for working within RFPs is, if you're responding to an RFP or if you're issuing an RFP, try to change one thing. You know, if you're issuing an RFP and you're looking at this outline and you feel like it doesn't map to some of the preferences or requirements we outlined today, if you can change one thing, if you can add, you know, a face-to-face meeting, if you can add a requirement that you're going to meet the project team, if you can start to, you know, change just one item within the RFP to move it more towards a meaningful document, then you've accomplished a lot. I think similarly on our side, on the agency side, if you're confronted with an RFP that you feel is not a fit, if you can articulate one, you know, one request, we want to change one thing, that's a step in the right direction to improving the RFP. There, so many of them are just found laying around in a search. You can start to improve the process through education on both sides. So that's my hope, my special hope, my Christmas wish for RFPs. Todd, what do you think Todd wanted to also share his idea?
I think we should stop responding to RFPs. I take a much more radical approach, and I already saw some eyebrows go up. If we all stop responding to them, they will stop writing them. Right?
Like an Occupy RFP.
Yes, exactly. Occupy
RFP. You kill
the
head and the body dies.
Right. Hashtag that right now.
Yes.
What I mean is, the idea of bids will never go away. Everybody needs to know how much a project is going to cost, not only the clients but the vendors, because the vendors need to know who to put on the project and what the resources will be and the timeline and all of that. Planning a project, coming up with some way to express your personal talents that you can contribute to something, we still need to do that, obviously. That's never, ever, ever going to go away. But the RFP proposal, I do this, you do that, I make this form, you fill it out, that is broken. We can stop doing it entirely and instead build relationships. So a lot of people here, I'm sure, are in the position to say, like, I'm not Happy Cog. You know, I don't have a name that people are going to recognize. It's going to be difficult for me to get work. But everybody at some point has been in a position where somebody just took a chance on them, right? Multiple times in everybody's lives, somebody has taken a chance on them. It really comes down to personal relationships. It comes down to, even if you're still filling out proposals and you're not well known, the person who accepts your proposal is still taking a chance on you, right? So build a personal relationship rather than a paper one. And eventually we can get rid of the notion of RFPs entirely. And instead just have a one-page thing, like Harvard, that says this is what we need to do with our website. Give us some ideas, but we don't expect you to do free work. Let's start to have a conversation. Let's talk to maybe 10 companies, whittle it down to 4, 3, or 2, and then have a really in-depth conversation and pick one, and then everybody's happy.
Amen. I had just,
please.
You did a survey. I don't even know really the composition, but like from an agency or design, digital design firm breakdown versus sort of client side, what's agency or design firms here? Oh, wow. Okay. And then client or issuer. Okay.
All right.
Other. Who's in other?
Software or anything, nothing has to do with agency? I'm sorry, I'll probably
no.
be brief.
Does anybody have any?
One thing, just on the client side, for the minority of folks from that side here, myself included, I think the success of an RFP is entirely in the hands of the client and the people and organization who issues it. You've got to, I think when I started at Dell, when we started talking, I was probably, since given my kind of years on the agency side, I was probably over-indexing or sort of being hypersensitive to all the bull crap that I had sort of endured for, 10, 12 years prior to kind of going to the other side. I was probably kind of going overboard and making sure that I felt what was getting issued was exactly the type of, RFP that I would have loved to have gotten. And the one that you guys got, just to show kind of how I think maybe simplified or how it doesn't require going to Google and kind of getting some, there's no magic bullet. A lot of the formatting here for this pretty sort of UX-driven strategic, document that was issued to a lot of different folks, the flow and sort of the order I picked up from an RFP I got 4 years ago from a company that is a hotel and water slide park chain. I can't remember the name of them now. But it just made sense, and it was totally, we didn't get the business, but it made sense, and it was, there were things like providing information and context for the people who are going to spend the time to invest in wanting to work with you. And so it could be that, or it could be something that is sort of strategic as what we were talking about. If there's a spirit to it that provides these folks context, that makes sure you don't waste their time, that you don't give these ambiguous answers about, well, you can, it's not spec work, but if you do some concepting, we'd love it. Hokum. You've got to be very clear with what you want from these folks. I think if you start it off with the right context and the right dialogue and the right transparency, it'll be the proper kind of foundation for that relationship. And if it doesn't happen then, at least you've got a new friend in the business. So I think that's at least, I don't know if it's advice, but that's been an experience, especially on the client side, that it's you can get around working with procurement and these larger company, these larger parts of the organization by, I think, just having an RFP that's real and human.
And I think if you're looking for examples of RFPs, you could go to the RFP database, which is kind of an aggregate of RFPs, just to see other options. I mean, if you're creating one or you're handed one from your procurement department, you do a little research on your own, you may be able to come back with a better document or a document that you can kind of combine and find a place in between. So that's a good place to start. Does anybody have any personal statements and or questions, sir?
We'll restate.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm an event designer. It's actually funny to see such huge vendor to client ratio because I guess all the vendors want to change their RFP program. And I think RFPs should do this. They should be lighter, and they should be a barrier to keep random vendors off the client, but they still should exist. Two things I would add. The first thing, it's very important to add a scoring system to the RFP, so how the work is going to be, how the response is going to be scored, how many points you get for a little company head count, how many points you'll get for delivery model and whatnot. And second thing is try to engage with several vendors for a pilot project. I know that doesn't sound right for smaller agencies, but actually, if the company really wants to get the job, it will invest into a pilot project to the vendor. And that's what we do with our clients. We try to cut down the RFP process to the smallest possible, get to the larger group of 100 you know, like two, three companies, the company to pilot with and do the actual job. Nothing would show you as a better company as important.
So the two recommendations for the podcast, who probably didn't hear that, were to add a pretty transparent quantitative scoring system to an RFP, and then also the idea of including a pilot project to get to a more discrete list of vendors through the evaluation process.
Sounds good. We've got one over here.
Developers write the proposals, but I was just curious what you have your sales team do. It's kind of unrelated to, you know, the direct topic, but it just kind of made me think. What do you guys have them doing if they're not writing the RFPs?
I mean, so in my role, that's my role within HappyCog, and I think that, you know, my job is really to insulate the directors from wasting their time on bad proposals or for pursuing the wrong kinds of products. So that's my responsibility number one, is to scrutinize opportunities and find the right projects. I think that my role in the proposal process is kind of a project manager, to kind of keep that process on schedule, to facilitate that dialogue. I think within our group, just, you know, as a snapshot, I still write the proposal. My job really is to build that document, deliver it to the client, go back and forth and all the kind of sales calls to get to that point. But it's certainly well informed by Mark and Jen and the other directors who collaborate with me in scoping out and speccing out and estimating the project, as well as, you know, customizing some language or you know, tweaking an approach to get to a point. We're not writing every proposal from scratch. We have a very beautiful template that Kevin Sharon designed for us that we use to build our proposals. So my role really is to kind of bring all those pieces together and facilitate the proposal that gets to the client, and then to follow through and you know, keep that dialogue alive. So I think that, you know, depending on how your sales funnel is built, is it built on cold calling? Is it built on responding to inquiries? You know, that's a piece that changes from organization to organization. But I do think that there is something to be said for a sales process that is embedded in the delivery team rather than a department or a layer or, you know, some kind of boundary between the clients. And it's just symptomatic of the way we work. You know, we don't have a client services department between the client and the folks that do the work. You know, when you're working with us, you're talking to the creative director, you're talking to the developer through the project. So it's more of a symptom of our culture than it is a visionary idea, but that's kind of how sales behaves within our team.
Mm-hmm. Four Kitchens, that almost identical. I would basically do the same thing that Joe does.
In the back. So the question was, the idea is moving away from kind of a fee structure and more to a performance-based model where you're kind of changing the way that the compensation happens and the way that the engagement starts. I think as an organization, we've moved slowly into more of a quantifiably measurable approach to the work we do. It's something that we've started to really invest more scrutiny into and understand better the actual impact of the project. So it's something that we've probably only started to scratch the surface of, so we're a little bit behind you in that regard. But I do think that Todd's experience in his world working in a more agile approach, the pain of a client not understanding what is the final bill going to be. It's not a fixed cost. It is more variable.
Right. So we work on a time and materials basis, which I guess is maybe more what you're talking about.
The outcome's kind of the same.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of gets into like project management philosophies, and like we're a scrum shop. So that's an unanswered question, actually. How can you effectively be agile from a project management perspective, build time and materials, but still hit deadlines and budgets and things like that? Because budgets and deadlines that's a very waterfall approach. If anybody here is familiar with project management methodology, it's something that we've been doing for about 6 years, and every day we learn something new. So I think that's part of a much bigger dialogue that we would definitely be interested in continuing. But it's really just a lot of keeping an eye on budget and time and resources every day.
And
that's
the
key. The
onus is on a visionary agency to educate the client and procurement on that process. I think that's, you know, if you decide to kind of move in that direction, you're kind of simultaneously deciding that I'm going to have to educate clients on the value of this approach and how they can actually budget for it. So it's a responsibility
kind of
off the shoulder.
Doing that.
Do Do you guys do entirely performance based, or is there a sort of a baseline? Yeah. I think that given the metrics now that you can actually bring into it, so it's more than just, I think it depends on the volume and the scale. Like you said, it's got to be sliding, but I mean, at least for Dell's standpoint, there are things that are built in. I don't have the specifics of it, but since it's sort of a high volume situation on our side, there's absolutely sort of a cost basis just so you're insured to have, a set number of resources. But I know the smaller places where, they're investment is so critical, and that marketing director is sort of on the hook for delivering. Those things are built in. I see that more and more, especially where I was before Dell, which is at a smaller shop where you can have those conversations, and it can actually be pretty, pretty good for the agency. If it works out.
So I think we're wrapped up. Yeah. I just want to mention that the deck is available on SlideShare. If you look for OMG RFP, you can grab this. There's some articles and some resources listed at the end that might be fun. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.